Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
And welcome to RV6. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk.
G'day, Tim.
And of course, as always, for my benefit, what's an RV?
An RV is a rendezvous. It is a point of consolidation. And in our RV, we consolidate on listener questions and reflections on previous episodes.
And we'll start with reflections on previous episodes. A Tale of Two Andrews. We deliberately sought to interview two federal politicians from either side of politics and talk no politics.
We failed. We talked a lot of politics. We didn't talk partisan politics.
Which I think is the critical thing.
That's what we meant. So, yeah.
Thoughts on the Tale of Two Andrews?
My first thought, and again, I've got to continue to thank Elizabeth Armstrong for introducing us to that wonderful passage from Orwell's Shooting the Elephant. But, you know, the further you are away from something, the clearer they become. It is easy to think that politicians are just these faceless, self-serving people from, you know, one side of politics or the other. But when you actually sit down and have a chat with them, as we did, these are interesting folk, clearly both very educated individuals, and I certainly got the impression both in it for the greater good. They are trying to make a difference and trying to do the best they can to improve the lives of their electorate. So I really enjoyed getting to know, we knew Andrew Hastie a little bit before, but to getting to know both of the candidates a little better and getting to understand that these are real human beings trying to do the best job they can.
Mm. And 80% of what happens in Canberra, we never hear about. We don't get those stories. And that 80% is very collegiate and very progressive. We get the sound bites that I think largely are just a mere distraction. And I completely agree with you. What we've been able to do, I think, in the Tale of Two Andrews is give an opportunity to humanise a federal politician. And the amount that they have to balance into this professional life, you know, the particularly for those people living outside of Canberra, the need to travel, in the case of Andrew Hastie, across the Nullarbor, across the continent, and then, you know, around their professional busy life, find time for them to maintain some fitness, constantly reintroduce themselves to their own family and their children, you know, get some time for recreational reading and all of the above. I mean, it's a real challenge and a phenomenal credit to them.
Yeah, absolutely impressive that you could find time to do all that. And not just in a sort of half-assed fashion. I mean, running a sub-3-hour marathon, learning a Shakespearean soliloquy, reading and writing as they both do. These aren't endeavours that you can do, you know, around the margins. These are significant investments in time. And it's, as you said, an absolute credit to them that they're squeezing that into their unforgiving minutes.
And I'm sure both of those Andrews would say, hey, it's not just about us. There are many politicians like us that are doing similar things and managing their lives in similar ways. I was going to talk about a sense of service that's reflected, I think, through those two interviews, but it's more than that. I think there's a real commitment to service and progressing the nation that certainly for me filtered through the interview with Andrew and Andrew.
Mm. Has it inspired you to run for a federal seat, Tim?
It has not.
Yep, nor me. Next question.
Okay, the second reflection that we're going to undertake, look at,
reflect upon,
review,
reflect upon a reflection,
is the episode with the externals, with Moff and Weimar.
Yep.
A little different, I think, to our previous episodes.
We did, yeah, there was a definite change in pace from the very in-depth conversations with the Andrews to some very in-depth conversations on a slightly lighter note with Harry and Weimar.
So in 1991, the externals were founded and they, you know, as you heard in that interview, started, believe it or not, on a resistance to interrogation phase of a reinforcement cycle, deciding that, oh, you sounded pretty good as you were singing across to our captors. Maybe we should start a band. And in the case of Weema, without a inch, an ounce, a minute of musical experience or training. And they graduated to levels where they were touring the nation, playing at major festivals, recording a series of albums, and still playing and enjoying each other's company. Reflections on the externals?
Well, your point about Weema not having any musical background, I mean, clearly he is an aficionado. He loves music. He's driven by it. He's passionate for it. I think it speaks to something that we're tapping into throughout this series, that, you know, that ability to be that average 70-kilo dickhead who sets their minds to something and is able to then pursue, you know, learn buy a bass and learn how to play and learn how to be in a rock band because you've got the passion. There's something in that, I reckon. It's that kind of person that I find fascinating, that can turn their mind to something and get the skills that for us mere mortals would seem to be, you know, unattainable.
So how about the critics? What was the comment offered by one of their critics that went into print?
Beautiful. The Orient, the famous Exploding White Mice gig at the Orient Hotel, where the critics said, and I messed it up when I first said it because I forgot all the evers, but the critic says, unless your IQ is lower than the cover charge, never, ever, ever see this band.
And that same critic was shaking Moff's hand some years later and awarding him a Solo Artist of the Year award.
Look, I've said before, we love our quotes, and there's probably none better than the famous Roosevelt, "It's not the critic who counts," Man in the Arena quote. And yeah, there couldn't be a more perfect example of that.
That one, and certainly being looked at critically by Warner Brothers to be signed by that particular label, being picked up by a subsidiary of Mushroom Records, recording multiple CDs, multiple albums, and continuing to play today. They've proven that critic wrong.
They certainly have. And I feel we, in some small way, may have contributed to the wider exposure to the externals. I don't think they were on Spotify until we hassled them in advance of this podcast to get some of their stuff up, mainly because we'd lost our CDs and we wanted to hear the tunes again. And certainly we both reflected Sail, fantastic album, great tunes. I've got very fond memories of more than one sort of military exercise away where that album was on repeat. Good times.
Yeah. A variety is certainly the spice of life, and Weema talked about, even though they were working in the SAS and working hard in the SAS with 6 months away, it was important that they had these other pursuits outside of the unit to balance them, to create friendships that were outside of their normal professional friendships, skills that were a little unique, and channel their energies in a more creative way.
I'm going to go one step further and say not only was it important as a sort of adjunct to their professional life, but I think it is a fantastic complement to their professional life. I look back on these great human beings, you know, the Renaissance men, as they were called then, but Renaissance folk, that weren't one-trick ponies. And I don't think it's any coincidence that their excellence, their interest, their passion in a broad variety of disciplines helped them achieve real virtuosity in different fields. And Da Vinci's the classic example, you know, inventor, strategist, obviously artist. He could also deadlift 220. He was a mate. Actually, I can't back that up about the deadlift. I'm sure he was probably physically active. You know,
he could probably touch his toes.
Possibly.
And I think the other thing, while we're still talking about the externals, is their contribution into the unit culture. But you know, into the wider music culture as well. So not only were they working above and beyond their normal day just to do something in that particular creative outlet, but it was important for the unit members.
100%. I mentioned that I think one of my first serious exposures to the SAS regiment had the external song in the soundtrack, that recruiting promotional video. And then to get to the unit, sort of meet these guys who, you know, don't tell Weema and Moff I said this, but were legends when you arrived as a bright young troop commander. not bright, bright-eyed young troop commander. And then to hear, you know, the stories, oh, that opened for Powderfinger, you know, all this sort of stuff. Mm. And then obviously once you get to meet them and see the humility and consummate professionalism from both of them, pretty impressive.
Yeah, and I met Weimer on my patrol course. It was in this period in the unit where we were encouraging unconventionality, and Weimer's a big guy, and he had this fully shaven head. I mean, razor shaven. He had an earring in the top of his ear. He was talking about playing rock music, but then he'd pull his pack on and grab his weapon, and some incredible leadership out of him. So the versatility, I think, again, we've talked many times about the versatility of people inside the unit. But yeah, that certainly was demonstrated. Mm. I think the other interesting thing is how much of a team sport this is. Moff talked about, 25 people and have played in the band. Mm-hmm. That's not including the roadies.
Yeah, that's right. And not insignificant.
Not insignificant.
You say that because that is right. A big, big component of it.
And the people on the door taking tickets, yep. That was certainly a thankless existence. And the externals as a team sport, or any musical endeavour as a team sport.
Or any endeavour, period, Timmy. You can't do it all by yourself.
That's very true. Okay, how about some questions?
We love questions from listeners. Thank you very much for all those people who do write in. We get stumped every time. We do a bit of research. We do sort of have a think about these because they're really good questions. We certainly don't profess to have the answers for them, but like all good SAS folk, we are often wrong, never in doubt, so we'll have a crack.
And this one's from Phil. He challenges us on an analogy, one that he's created. He has been struck by the concept that leadership is a combination of the learnt and the experienced. And we always say that theory, while necessary,
is not sufficient.
He has been thinking of an analogy that works into that leadership domain. And he's come up with the theory of learning to drive versus learning to lead. Learning to drive being a combination of theory and of experience, clearly. And people are not able to drive well unless they've learnt the theory and obey the rules. But while the theory is good, it's not enough. And equally, while we're learning to drive, there's also great value in the guidance of an experienced driver to help provide positive encouragement and comment.
I reckon there is a lot of goodness in this analogy. I'd never even thought of it, but the more you think about it, the more I think that there is value. And I've actually spoken with Phil on this. The one area where I reckon you'd want to expand upon it is that idea of teamwork we were just speaking about. But so much about it, you know, the idea of mentoring or of having a mentor and that vicarious modelling component of both leadership and driving is true. Phil talks about things like the dangers of driving aggressively and too close to others being very similar. Mm. And we've spoken about balconies and dance floors before, that really difficult balance you have to strike as a leader between management by walking around, getting down on the dance floor and understanding what's going on at the coalface and stepping back and understanding the picture, or the big picture. That's exactly the same as driving. You can't sort of be right on focused on the bumper in front. You need to be living in your rear view. You need to be looking 500 metres ahead for the dangers. You need to zoom in and out in exactly the same way.
Mm, yeah, 95% of driving is mundane and reasonably straightforward, but in 5% of circumstances, dangers expose themselves.
Phil also says that there's a fun and abstract side of both driving and leadership. He makes the comment that we all think we're good at both, and very few of us actually are. I reckon that's a great one. We love inventing statistics on the Unforgiving 60, but something like 70% of people think they're above average drivers.
86% of all statistics are made up.
And certainly it's higher on this show. But I think that's true, that leadership should be seen as something that you take pleasure in and take satisfaction in. But I think when you start believing either that you're got nothing left to learn as a leader or a driver, then an accident is probably not far away.
Mm. And whether you're a driver or a pilot, you know, you can sit in the simulator. What's the version of the leadership simulator where you don't necessarily want to expose your flaws and failings?
I reckon training and exercises are good ones. Certainly the military does this well. We train, do lots of courses, that sort of thing, which allows you to fail in that safe environment. And I think, you know, it's a different environment in most profit-making entities. You know, we need to be doing the job day to day. But the more we, as leaders, can create an environment where it is safe to experiment a little and fail, to crash in the simulator rather than in the real life, then I think the better off we're going to be, and the more we will develop our junior leaders, our subordinates as leaders.
And the simulations that we run, certainly in the crisis and emergency management work, we get some great feedback from leaders that get an opportunity to practice against those simulated scenarios that are realistic, that are plausible, that are feasible. And there's not too many organisations that truly, management teams, that truly get a chance to come together as a team and practice under a little bit of pressure, the coherence of teamwork under pressure.
Yep. There is nothing, I guess, more rewarding than hearing after an event people say, you know, that was the first time I'd been in, you know, insert incident X, a gunfight or a corporate crisis or whatever, but it was just like we rehearsed. I mean, I think if you've got that level of reality-based training and that people are inoculated to those unique stresses of incidents and of leadership challenges, then you're halfway there.
And good drivers generally always have a driving instructor. Could be someone from inside your house, could be someone that's externally engaged. And Stanley McChrystal says something similar for leaders. And we often get the question, how do I get started? How do I find a mentor? A really great way to do that is kind of look ahead and up at someone that you truly admire and that inspires you. Dissect that, work out why, and try and emulate it. The second thing to do in the McChrystal model is look at a peer that perhaps is doing things in a different way to you, and work out whether that's effective. Try and emulate that. And the last thing he says is look at someone who's doing a role that you have previously done that might be doing it better, and accept that as well.
I'd add two things onto that. The first one is that emulation, of course, is not trying to be that person. We're big proponents of authentic leadership. And so by emulate, we're looking at the successful characteristics and how they might fit into your own style, not trying to be exactly like the other person. And the other thing I'd add is look down. Look at your subordinates. Have that humility to look at people who are working for you, but who maybe just have that natural gift with people or have that natural influence within your organisation. We can certainly learn from all quarters.
Absolutely. 360 degrees of leadership learning. Completely agree. Thanks, Phil, for that question. Well, actually, for the analogy.
Yeah, it's a good one. And you heard it first here, although we've probably already credited Phil with the idea.
Now, we also were asked a question on the SAS selection course. We are going to do an episode on SAS selection and lessons learnt from selection that could be applied into the corporate world. So let's just ring fence that question for that particular episode. We do have a question on grand strategy. We're getting a little highbrow. This one's from Lachlan. He says that Ben, you and I and others that have perhaps been in similar or higher positions than us have been part of a precision instrument that has been deployed often at the highest level of government as the force of last resort. And the question that he asks is, have you ever asked yourself, was it right? Is the government right?
Lachlan, I think this is a really interesting question. If you go back to the Baby Officer Bible, Karl von Clausewitz's On War, you'll find Clausewitz talking about war being an extension of politics by another means. So at its fundamental level, we use militaries to achieve political end states. That makes good sense. And I think, you know, we don't want militaries in charge of countries. Militaries are good at a lot of military stuff. We haven't got good track records of being, of running countries in a lot of cases. But I think we need to recognise that when we use the military as a nation, that it is to achieve ultimately a diplomatic goal. I'm not convinced there's always that political driver, or that when there is, it's always that clear. And I think recent cases, Libya springs to mind as one where potentially there wasn't a clear political agenda when the military instrument was employed, which can make it really confusing when you're talking about the cascading of a vision or a mission down to day-to-day activity, particularly in a case where the stakes are high, as they always are in martial environments. And so I think, yes, there have been a number of circumstances where that cascade of political intent down to the military has not been particularly clear. And I think that it in a couple of cases, has resulted in a rather confused outcome.
Poetry. Alfred Lord Tennyson, in the charge of the Light Brigade, said, "Theirs is not to reason why, theirs is but to do and die." And I think if you are giving service to the government and questioning the decisions being made, then you're probably not in the right role. And there's a really great book on the seizing of the MV Tampa called Dark Victory by Wilkinson and Marr that talks about the employment of the SAS in seizing that particular vessel. One thing I can say, and that certainly that book provides commentary from all angles, you know, political, inside the uniform component, the way that they interface, as well as the plight of the refugees and the ship owners. The one thing I can say, having been employed in a couple of these styles of operations, is that you don't really focus on the government's decision to send you there. You recognise that that's a fait accompli, and really you just want to do the job to the best of your ability.
I'd agree. There's a fantastic scene in Black Hawk Down, which I reckon is a cool movie, where Eric Banner reflects something very similar, that, you know, by the time it gets to that point, you're not fighting for Queen or country or a flag or a mission even. You're fighting for your mate. You're fighting for the person next to you, which I think at that very coalface tactical level is the case.
Next question is on honour and mottos. So the business world rarely uses the word honour, and the questioner's take on honour is that it's a mix of honesty and integrity. This particular listener writes that a lot of businesses talk about integrity but miss the honesty part. Is this a failing, Ben? The military used honour often, so why do you think this difference exists?
I think it's a wider societal issue where we've seen a lot of rules-based organisations creeping in. And I like this idea of honour. You know, I would be hard-pressed to clearly define the difference between honour and integrity. But these sort of concepts are kind of captured in that idea of doing the right thing when no one's watching. You know, of understanding what right looks like and doing it to the best of your ability, even without the carrot or the stick, even without supervision, even, as I said, when no one's watching. And I think that the more that we create rules-based systems, the less we incentivize people to understand what principles are, and the less we empower them to do the right thing. So we create these environments where, as long as you stick by the rules, you know, if you can find that tax loophole, then have at it. It's not illegal. It's not against the rules. But none of us could argue that that is a very honourable way to live. And I think the more rules we've got in, and the more we err towards a rule-based system, and the further away from a principles-based system or society that we go, then the less we incentivise these ideas of honour, and the easier it is to become just following those rules, finding those loopholes, and achieving or living your life through that.
In the first couple of weeks of joining the army, you have to learn the military ethos. And I actually think that the military ethos, which, by the way, has stuck with me for my whole professional career since rote learning it in the first couple of weeks, is a great beacon by which you can judge your behaviours and your actions. And the ethos is loyalty, responsibility, and commitment. I think that there's another component to that, which is integrity above all else. thoughts on the military ethos? You must have failed that particular part.
I don't remember any of that. I think that says a lot about me, a whole bunch of reasons. But that's exactly that concept of principle that if... And you see other organisations with ethoses that, you know...
Is it one ethos, two ethoses?
With ethi. I reckon that's a great yardstick where if you judge an action by that, rather than trying to find in section 68, part 2, 3, bravo, you against that rule, just to be able to say, you know, were you acting with integrity? Were you acting in a manner that's loyal to this organisation? Mm. It makes it, I think, a lot clearer in terms of how you need to deal with any given behaviour. Mm,
demonstrating loyalty, demonstrating responsibility, demonstrating commitment, and demonstrating integrity. I really like that. I would hope that when I'm on my deathbed, people might judge me by those four things, and I would hope that I would be judged favourably against those four things.
People would be judging you.
Not too late to change my will at that particular point in time. Right. I might not bequeath you anything.
I was going to ask. I'm not expecting a big payout.
No, that's right. That's right. I might get my war trunk or something just in case Red Dawn happens. Okay, the second question is about the SAS motto, which is, Ben?
Who dares wins.
And the immediate perception that motto, who dares wins, seems somewhat reckless. But maybe on deeper reflection, it indicates something a little bit more deliberate. Who dares wins.
We currently do a lot of work in the risk space, and my view is that a lot of organisations see risk as a dirty word, you know, that it is something we want to eliminate completely and get rid of, and we should never entertain any form of risk. And I think that idea is a bad one. The flip side of risk is, of course, opportunity. And without the ability to take some calculated risks, then you're unable to reap the opportunity and the benefits. And of course, if humankind had never taken any risks, then we wouldn't have achieved all these wonderful things we have. So I think my interpretation of that who dares wins is less about that reckless concept and more about the idea of a very calculated risk. So lots of preparation and being in a position through your training, your preparation, your professional excellence, to be able to assess clinically the risks inherent in any given course of action and then take those appropriate ones, dare to win on the basis of that preparation. It's not just about launching headlong into certain death. It's quite the opposite.
Mm. We were at a breakfast this morning and someone asked us, you know, what do you two guys do? And we used the line that we actually use on this podcast. We're two ex-SAS guys with MBAs. And it's easy to contextualize that little soundbite by breaking that down. As former SAS guys, we understand risk. We understand how to plan ahead of risk and also how to mitigate it. And the MBA component means that we can contextualize that into the business environment. And, you know, if I were to talk a little journey, Ben, about jumping with your patrol out of an aircraft with boats at night over the horizon to commence a transit in and patrol, you would think, geez, that sounds phenomenally dangerous. Mm. But it's not really. And why isn't it?
Because of all of those safeguards that I just spoke about in terms of the preparation, the planning, the rehearsals, the check, recheck, that go into a mission. Mm. And this, to me, allows you to do something with a high degree of perceived danger,
mm.
but actually be quite calculated in its execution.
And breaking all of those parts down, everyone that's about to jump out of that aircraft is not just a qualified parachutist, but an experienced parachutist. They're going to jump with a primary parachute and a reserve parachute. They will have already jumped at night without all of that gear from the same aircraft. They're about to jump into water that they have chosen to jump into, you know, so the sea state will be right. They'll be using equipment that they prepared, that again they're qualified in, they're current and competent in, and then they'll be undertaking a task across that horizon into landmass that they're incredibly familiar with, in a group of people that they're incredibly familiar with.
That's a really good point. And so this sum total of all of those tiny little bits seems this very dangerous, as you mentioned before, high degree of perceived risk activity. but this isn't the first time that those people have done the individual components. It's not the first time they've put them together. There's been a very graduated increase. And again, it comes back to those ideas that we spoke about the start of this particular episode, that, you know, those massive, lofty, insurmountable goals, people achieve them, and they achieve them by stringing one foot in front of the other with a clear path towards that goal, building up that experience, building up that knowledge, building up that capability.
Mm. And then we add in threat, or let's call it enemy, but that same element will have taken a very close look at the enemy, the enemy's capabilities, where they happen to be, their habits, intentions, morals, their tactics, techniques, procedures. They will have worked a plan to deny the capabilities to affect that particular patrol.
Yeah. And like every good plan, it will not survive first contact with the enemy.
It's a common basis for change.
And everyone has one until you get punched out. We got a lot of cliches on plans. But yeah, there is that adaptive mindset that, you know, the planning has been thorough, but there's no expectation it's going to roll out exactly as we thought.
That's right. So as soon as you step outside of the aircraft, and maybe even before, when you start interacting with that environment, that complex environment, you're going to have to adapt and think and change on the move.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's certainly not a cavalier leap out the back of the aircraft screaming, who dares wins. It's very much a planned and practice and built up capability.
Mm, and we always said when we were planning in the squadron, Ben, that hope is not a course of action, and you wouldn't allow anyone to jump onto that aircraft, certainly as a squadron commander, if you hadn't received a back brief of their plan, if you weren't 100% comfortable that they'd thought everything through, including contingencies, branches and sequels, and they had concepts at least against those branches and sequels.
Yep, that's true. Although I still did very much hope they all got to the ground in one piece.
Well, having had an entanglement with other paratrooper, which is an in-flight emergency, I can attest that that's not one of my preferred methods of getting to the battlefield.
Was hope one of your task verbs at that point?
It had to be. Yeah, okay. And on the topic of the externals, what we thought we would do is finish with a song that we did expose a little bit in the externals episode called I Don't Believe It. Do you want to narrate perhaps what I Don't Believe It, how that was important to you and, for that matter, me?
Definitely. And I touched on that earlier in this episode, but this was the first external song I'd ever heard. It was on the back of a recruiting video, which we mentioned in the externals episode. Had all the cool stuff that you can do in the SAS regiment.
Close quarter battles, some parachuting, some boats.
Things blowing up and people jumping out of planes and cars driving fast and people wearing black suits and gas mask. And Tim, you can take your gas mask off.
Again, I keep wearing it.
It's a good joke. But yeah, it was really motivational and a good tune. I reflected with Weimer and Moff that I thought it was Pearl Jam. It's got a pretty cool sort of grungy sound about it. And then later found out that it was the externals, how cool those guys were. And then for me, that real bookend was actually playing this song with the band at the regiment's 50th birthday. I very much felt that that was a nice little bookend to my experience with this tune.
And again, a special shout out to the externals who do provide their music to us, and thank you very much to them. You will find some of their tunes on Spotify, and we're trying to encourage them to leap into the year 2019 by loading the old albums onto Spotify and also onto iTunes, and they assure us that they're in the process of doing that.
So keep the questions coming. Thank you very much for your feedback, and in the meantime, enjoy the externals with I Don't Believe It.
See you next time on The Unforgiving 60.
I don't believe it.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60, that's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60.
Get around and meet my friends. Folks come here.